virtue. Thank you for joining us here on Hadith of the Day. We were looking at the virtue of using perfume in the words and the sunnah of the Holy Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam. Until next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Dr. Shiraz Hossein Aqa for the program Hadith of the Day on RIB English Radio.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad.
The spotlight.
Doing us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The spotlight.
The UK government is in chaos. The Chancellor of the Exchequer was just sacked by the UK Prime Minister Liz Truss, placed by Jeremy Hunt, the former Foreign Secretary, who somehow is now fit to be the Finance Minister. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at how and what went so wrong for Prime Minister Liz Truss and her so-called mini-budget, with calls ringing louder for her resignation, and whether there is a lifeline for the UK economy or not. First, let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Historian and journalist Tony Gosselin joins us from London. Also joining us is President of the European Institute for International Law, Mahmoud Rafat, who joins us from Stockholm.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to you both. Tony Gosselin, I'll first start with you. Basically, let's find out from you what is your explanation behind what is going on, especially when it comes to this mini budget, which is now turned out to be a real crisis for Liz Truss and her premiership.
Well, I think there's a certain degree of sabotage going on within the British economy. We had a whole month during September where there was a leadership contest between Rishi Sunak and Liz Truss, and the promise that Truss gave to all of those Conservative Party members was, "I will reduce your taxes." Well, of course, they just were thinking with their wallets and voted for her. The trouble is that actually there is nowhere that she could reduce taxes at all, really, because the markets have reacted in the way that the only way they could, which is to say, well, if you're going to reduce taxes, that means that the government borrowing, it cannot be paid back, and therefore we're going to have to, really, I suppose, punish you and tell you that we want the government to be able to pay its debts, and that's what they've done. The markets have punished them. They've said if you're going to be cutting taxes, you're not going to be able to fulfil your budgetary needs in paying all these debts back. The fact is, the only place where at the moment where Truss and the government can actually get enough tax in is from the super rich, and these are the one group of people and the most powerful businesses. The businesses are very good at not paying tax, by the way, but the super rich, as they get paid income in Britain, they have to, you know, it's very easy to take that tax off them, and she was going to cut that. So, I mean, it was a disastrous policy from the start, just built on greed from the Conservative Party members voting for her. But as I said, I think there's an element of sabotage here. There are some powerful influences out there that do want to see economies crash. We've seen it in many other countries around the world, okay. Argentina. I mean, the list goes on. And what happens is, as those economies start to crash, because most people think, well, you don't want that to happen, but some people do want that to happen, is they are then able to buy up all those assets for very little money and make an absolute fortune. We're talking about the people like George Soros, international dealers and traders that can make a fortune on a crash. This is the trouble, is the international markets, particularly those centred in the EU and in London, in the city, and in Wall Street, are basically like a casino. And so games are played, and that's what's been happening. And Liz Truss has completely lost touch with reality. This Chancellor, what they were doing is they were trying to do things which just had no economic sense to them whatsoever. And so I think now Kwarteng has gone, Liz Truss is going to have to go very soon because she backed him all the way. And the Conservative Party is going to have to find a new leader.
Well, we're going to get to those topics, especially the one that you say that there's maybe sabotage going on. But Mahmoud Rafat, if you can tell us in layman terms, what was so wrong with this mini budget that caused such a crisis, which has put into question the credibility of Liz Truss and her administration as a whole?
Well, which is appearing for us is the taxes problem and the bad plan which was put by the government of Truss, and especially to apply the same taxes on rich and poor, which represents a big contradiction with the social justice and also with the logic. But let's say, or let me repeat, this is what is appearing. Prime Minister Truss carried the heritage of long history of bad politics and also big messy. Don't forget, the Brexit is one of elements we can say not endamaged, but somehow broke big part of the British economy. Let's say also the markets in UK are not stable at all because of the big potentiality of the independence of Scotland next year, which will be followed for sure by independence of North Ireland. There is lots of elements she carried them as a heritage, or this government carried them, but she did not work on solving one of these dark elements. On the contrary, her government put a catastrophic plan, especially economic plan. Also, the involvement in UK strongly in the Russian-Ukrainian war was supporting one side, not only economically or militarily, but strategically. That's putting the UK economy in the same package or the same bucket of the war. And when there are wars, we always see investors do not trust so much in such economy. There is big trust used to be in the French economy, which we no longer find today because of lots of elements she did not create, but she aggravated the situation by the tax cutting.
Well, let's get into what the Institute of Fiscal Studies has said here, Tony Gosling, because basically they pretty much hit the target when they talked about this mini budget. They called into question in terms of where the money was going to come from. And that was about, £60 billion that the UK will need in spending cuts. It said that unfunded tax cuts need to create that money. But how will the UK kind of be able to do that? Of course, we know in the books they have forecasted a certain percentage of growth. I think it was 2.5%. But they said at best 0.7 or 0.8% is how much the UK economy is going to grow. So that's a blatant piece of fact that's out there. How did Liz Truss and her former exchequer plan to convince people of that, which at this point is a void now?
I don't think they thought it through at all. I think that they had basically taken a few lines from an advertising agency in order to get themselves into power, get themselves elected in the election campaign over the summer, but they hadn't actually thought about what the implications might be. Look, let me just spell out a couple of basics here, because there is this thing called quantitative easing or printing money that the Bank of England's been doing. It's been using that money that it's created to purchase government bonds this week. It's just decided yesterday it's going to stop doing that, apparently, which means on Monday when the market's open, God only knows what's going to happen. We could have all sorts of problems with pensions. House prices could tank, mortgage rates going up. You know, this is becoming much more expensive for ordinary people. What should really happen with the money the Bank of England are making it up is they should just gift it to people on who are on benefits, people who are on low pay, people that can't afford to buy food or having to go to food banks. Give it to them. Give each one of those people who are having to claim government subsidies or Social Security or whatever £2,000, because you know what? They'll spend the money and that will help all other elements of the economy. Because the way that they're spending this money at the moment is just going into the pockets of the people who have shares, and it's going in for asset purchases, and it's going to the rich, basically. So give that money, Bank of England, to the poor, and you'll see the economy start to pick up. So that's a really basic thing to understand. I mean, what we've had is, you're right, lots of instability. July, the Chancellor was Rishi Sunak. August, the Chancellor was Nadeem Zahawi. September, the Chancellor was Kwasi Kwarteng. And now in October, we've got another Chancellor, Jeremy Hunt. It gives the impression the Conservative Party haven't got a clue what they're doing.
Exactly.
And it's very unlikely that they will come up with policies now which will help the poorer people, which is the poor are the only ones who will actually manage to pick the economy up, I think, and get it moving again.
Well, you touched on a very important point there. And Mahmoud Rafat, just plain logic dictates when you have a position such as that, finance minister or the exchequer, have different people fill that position three times now, and you're having the fourth person come into the picture, Hunt, who has varied jobs in the past that don't exactly constitute to him being an expert on finances in a country, I'm guessing. That's just a sign of disarray. And then furthermore, you know, a certain amount of time has passed, in a very crucial period of time. That's, you know, you're rocked by so many different economic factors. How can, after all these people to have come and gone, for there to be a promise of stability in the economic life of Britain, so to speak?
Well, let's say it's not questions only of experts. Always the economy is a follower to politics. And policies impact the economy and the functioning of the economy in any country over the world, whatever to be the degree of democracy of this country or this nation. The question is, and matters not left completely to experts' opinions. No, the politicians and decision makers who are not experts financially intervenes in lots of matters. And also their policies, they put damage lots of plans put by experts. And this is which explains also the bad politics, especially last decades, especially last one decade. And the policies were adopted by politicians in UK were completely in lots of situations wrong politics and wrong policies, which led today to this heritage I was talking about a few minutes ago. Madame Truss has carried when she entered Downing Street. While, again, the question is not only one reason. We have lots of reasons. United Kingdom has been accumulating lots of reasons to drop down today. It's not something happened last week or last month. It's bad policies, bad interventions in some areas of the world.
How far back would you go with that?
Well, let's just have a look what happened in the Middle East last decade and the UK intervention in last decade. UK did not intervene rationally as all as its history, comparing to its history of intervention. It's all the colonial empireship should have big experience how to intervene and how to act when there are conflicts, while we found the UK intervening completely wrongly since 2003, even before that, since the Iraq War.
I just want to get an idea about the time frame that you were talking about. I'm sorry to jump in because I want to now ask that question from you, Tony Gosselin. Our guest there talked about a decade, but then he went back all the way to 2003. Tell us if you think that this is something that's either been in the making for quite some time or something that the UK maybe never really recovered from based on the 2008 financial crisis. If you want to take a look at the origins of, I guess, wrong policies or what have you.
Well, I can be absolutely precise to say, really, the origin of this is 1976. That is the removal of Harold Wilson, who was the Prime Minister, by the army in Britain and the far right and the right-wing army in Britain. They kicked him out of office and replaced him with James Callaghan. Anyone that doesn't know about this, there are some very good books on it. The Enemy Within, I think, is one of them, and The Wilson Plot is another one. Very interesting the way he was got, because he was managing the economy for the Labour Party, for the British people. And ever since then, we've had then, of course, the Thatcher era began in the 1980s. And that, I think, is actually the start of finance capitalism getting a grip on Britain. That is to say, everything is privatised bit by bit. I mean, Thatcher, it was like every 2 or 3 months, another major state-owned industry was sold off to the international markets. And that meant that anybody in the world with a lot of money could just buy up British infrastructure. This was a beginning of the end, in a way, and what they called at the time Thatcher selling off the family silver. So now finance capitalism, whatever it is, 40 years later, has become absolutely king. Finance capitalism dictates the policies to prime ministers, checkers at their private residence. Finance capitalism dictates which broadcasters are owned by who. And so the two main organs that the public have got to defend them from voracious, rich, acquisitive people, that is to say, a democratic parliament and the press, are both taken over by finance capitalists. And that's happened with the opposition Labour Party too here in the UK, where we've got a so-called opposition party which doesn't even support ordinary workers around the country, as we're getting lots of strikes starting in Britain now, even keep with their wages keeping pace with inflation. Now, if the Labour Party can't even support that, they're clearly working, just as the Conservatives are, for the finance capitalists, for the City of London. And what we really need is a mixed economy where we have a government that asserts its strength, controls its infrastructure, and makes sure the poorest and the most or the least well-off in the country are looked after, as well as the super-rich. This government and actually the opposition Labour Party really only care about the super-rich that pay their wages for their political parties now.
I'm going to get back to that point, see if I can add something to that to challenge you. But, okay, we got about 5 minutes left, max. Mahmoud Rafat, so here we are, and here is the UK, and here is what they're dealing with. How are they going to move forward? What do they have in mind in terms of what anything that points towards some kind of recovery from what's happened? I mean, you have Jeremy Hunt that has come forward, and he has again made a U-turn. I lost count on how many U-turns have been made from the beginning of this. Two were cited. I think I counted five based on what Jeremy Hunt has also said. But how can the UK move forward based on your analysis to come out of this situation and for there to be some stability there?
Well, I don't think there is a magic solution. It's not a bottom we will hit. We will find a solution for the economy and we will get back the economic stability and the purchase power will get back affordable by society. I don't think that will happen in the close future. In particular, I'm repeating again, the question of the referendum of Scotland, it will be a big and huge earthquake if the Supreme Court of the UK accepted the case and Scottish went to referendum, the big chance is to vote yes. And that will represent earthquake, not only for the economy, by the way, but on the whole life of the United Kingdom. But, well, simply, this nation will not exist anymore. The United Kingdom will not be the United Kingdom anymore, or the Great Britain anymore. It will be England. So there is no quick solution. There are some suggestions to be adopted on a very long term. When I say long term, it's not one decade, it's around between 2 to 5 years in order to get some stability. But that will not be, we will never be able to start on that until the decision of the Supreme Court concerning Scotland, and if yes, to see the vote results and what will happen after this result, to start from there, from 2023, when the shape of the relationship between Scotland and UK has been appeared, at that time, we will be able to start some procedures and to give the case and the files really to the experts without interventions of politicians.
Well, you have to have a stable government to do that. And you talked about the Labour Party there, and you, Tony Gosling, and you talked about how there should be a mixed, I forgot the term that you used.
Mixed economy.
But the Labour Party says that the Tories have lost the right to govern. And they're saying that the Conservative Party is just going to try to cling to power. And if it does that, it's going to bring down the country with it. What other options does UK have then?
Well, look, do you want Tony Blair back? I mean, because Starmer is even more extreme than Tony Blair. So he also has lost the right to govern. No, I think there are some very simple, quick solutions, but these are actually taboo. But the simple, quick solution, number one, is what I said before, is the people's quantitative easing. That is to say, printing money and giving it to the poor in order to kickstart the economy, you know, maybe even give £10,000 to everybody with no savings. A very simple thing that they could be doing, and that would be a fraction of the money that the Bank of England have been giving to the rich over the last, isn't it now 15 years, is it nearly, that they've been, well, no, not quite, but a long time anyway. So the people's QE, give that to poor people. The other thing they can do is they can regulate the privatised industries, all of the infrastructure, the railways, the electricity, the water, the gas. They can just restrict that, and they can renationalise it for free. And once the government is able to set the prices properly so that there's no racketeering going on in the infrastructure, everybody will be able to get on and make some money. So there's two very basic things. Another one, of course, is the bankers that were responsible for what we call the banksters for the financial crisis.
Sure.
The criminal bankers, they must be arrested and put in jail. I think those three measures would make a tremendous amount of difference and put the British economy back on track again.
With that, we come to an end, unfortunately, of this edition of The Spotlight. I'd like to thank Tony Gosling, historian and journalist, and also like to thank Mahmoud Rafat, president of the European Institute for International Law. That does it for this edition of The Spotlight. From Yacoub Tagoué and the team, it's goodbye until next time.
Insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the Compassionate, the Merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu Alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hausa Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us. Allah.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد لله رب العالمين، ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين. In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. Hello everyone, I'm Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, and we're going to be with you with another edition of the program Insights into the Holy Quran. And in this edition of the program, we'll try to discuss the commentary of chapter Shu'ara, the 26th chapter of the Holy Quran. We'll be back after you listen to the verses we're going to discuss in this episode.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم واتل عليهم نبأ إبراهيم.
And recite to them the news of Abraham.
إذ قال لأبيه وقومه ما تعبدون.
When he said to his father and his people, what do you worship?
قالوا نعبد أصناما فنظل لها عاكفين.
They said, we worship idols and remain to them devoted.
Brothers and sisters, as you were previously with us, we reached the 70th verse of chapter Shu'ara, the 26th chapter of the Holy Quran. إذ قال لأبيه وقومه ما تعبدون. And the 71st verse, قَالُوا نَعْبُدُ أَصْنَامًا فَنَظَلُّ لَهَا عَاكِفِينَ. After the wonderful story of Prophet Moses, عَلَى نَبِيِّنَا وَأَلِيُّ عَلَيْهِ السَّلَامَ, and what happened to him, and specifically what happened to the people of Pharaoh, the Holy Quran starts the story of Prophet Abraham to soothe and console his prophet, sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam, more. It is implied that even the close relatives of this prophet were not believing in the Lord of the worlds. They were idolaters and pagans. And Prophet Abraham started his invitation to monotheism from his close relatives and kinship. The verse says, إِذْ قَالَ لِأَبِيهِ وَقَوْمِهِ مَا تَعْبُدُونَ. When he said to his father and his people, what do you worship? Surely, Prophet Abraham knew the answer to this question. But maybe he wanted to kind of humiliate them by asking, مَا تَعْبُدُ. But in answer to this question, they immediately said that they used to worship idols every day and that they respected them while taking care of them. The verse says, قَالُوا نَعْبُدُ أَصْنَامًا فَنَظَلُّ لَهَا عَاكِفِينَ. They said, we worship idols, and we are ever devoted unto them. This kind of answer that they gave Prophet Abraham shows that not only did they not feel any shame for their action, but also they were really proud of their deed. Because after saying this sentence, نَعْبُدُ أَصْنَامًا, we worship idols, which was sufficient for the answer of the question that the Prophet Abraham posed, they added, فَنَظَلُّ لَهَا عَاكِفِينَ, and we are ever devoted unto them. This means we are sure and we are firm in our decision. The Arabic phrase nadallu is applied for the things which are usually done during the day. And now that it has been used in the simple present form, it shows the continuity and permanence of the action. Nadallu laha akifin means we are completely and we will be devoted unto them. Also, the Quranic word akif means the one who pays attention to something and takes care of it respectfully and with responsibility. This is also a further emphasis on the former meaning, nadallu, which means we will take care of our idols and we are really firm in our decision. The Arabic word asnam is the plural form of sanam, which you may already know. And it is a kind of statue which is made of gold or silver or wood or other things. And this is what we refer to as idol. And the polytheists used to worship it, and they considered it a symbol for their sacred things.
We hope and pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with the ability to cover more of His divine
In this
word.
Series of programs, we will inshallah discuss the Holy Quran with a thematic approach.
We will inshallah discuss the chapter.
تعلقا وتلاه في جنح الدجى متدبرا.
The context in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks in this verse is the context of mentioning the ills and problems and evils of the people of the book, the previous nations who have received revelation, and more particularly the Jew.
Now let's listen to some of the verses of the Holy Quran.
First, let's listen to a few verses.
Now let's listen to some verses of the Holy Quran.
Insights into the Holy Quran. By Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom.
Dear listeners, there are some points, however, regarding these two verses. The first point is that the Prophet Abraham used the form of a question for the start of the conversation, and he tried to awaken their souls with this question. Questioning the people and their deeds is one of the effective ways in invitation and in waking them up from the sleep of ignorance. And another interesting thing regarding the verse is that the Holy Quran just cares about what is important of the story of the Holy Prophets. In this part, the Holy Quran does not mention the name of the ones or the number of the people who were there or the name of the place and exact time of that event. No, the Holy Quran just tells us the main point, and the focal point of the story is that the Holy Prophet Abraham used to invite his close people and close relatives. Thank you, brothers and sisters, for staying with us in this episode. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key. Unwind all the secrets this life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also visit our website at parstoday.com. Until the next program, take care.
Things always, but for me, worry ends when faith begins.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Said Puraza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Said Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
The battered town of Obeznoy. I came here to find out if locals are fearful of the Ukrainian army, who have made recent gains not far to the west. A local school in the center of town.
Yes, we are worried. If the Ukrainian army comes here, there will be reprisal against teachers. But our strength is in the hope that it will never happen. I have colleagues whose children happen to be on the other side. They are afraid of coming to work because they are scared for their children and themselves.
Why do you think Ukraine would kill teachers? What's the reasoning behind that?
They say that we are ideological frontline workers and we are involved in Russian propaganda. This is the main thing that teachers are blamed for, but this region is 80% Russian speakers.
Irina, who's lived in this town all her life, tells me that she has heard rumors that teachers have been killed in Kapiansk, a town recently taken by Ukraine. This shocking video was posted online, claiming to be civilians in Kapiansk. It was uploaded by Maxim Zorin, a former member of Ukraine's notorious Azov Regiment, although he later altered his post, claiming the video had been taken from a Russian soldier's phone.
Now, to my knowledge, this is the only video that has surfaced in this war so far that clearly shows civilians being executed and dumped into a mass grave. Now, this video has been completely ignored by the mainstream media of NATO countries. Why? Because the evidence suggests a strong likelihood that these are Ukrainian soldiers executing pro-Russian civilians.
A headline from Britain's Daily Mail newspaper. The article quotes an advisor to Ukraine's Interior Ministry. A hunt has been declared on collaborators, and their life is not protected by law. Our intelligence services are eliminating them, shooting them like pigs. A humanitarian center. The Ukrainian government have not only threatened teachers, but those who distribute or receive humanitarian aid with jail.
We did nothing bad. We tried to help children and elderly people. What did we do? We were giving out aid under shelling. We helped people who couldn't walk. What shall we be afraid of? We just helped. I think there's nothing bad in it.
One of the volunteers asks us for a lift to help an old woman nearby.
What do you think of the Ukrainians threatening people who take humanitarian aid?
We heard of it. We even saw a video that in Kupiansk, some guys were taken into trenches and shot in the head. We have no internet, no proof. But they say there are nationalistic battalions that do it. It shouldn't be so. We are all people. Russian, Ukrainian, Belarusian.
While thousands of pro-Russians flee Ukrainian advances in fear, those that remain in areas taken over by Ukraine risk execution due to their political leanings. Indeed, most in Donbass expect a genocide or ethnic cleansing of Russian speakers if the Ukrainians were to ever reconquer the region. Johnny Miller, Rebeznoy, Donbass.
In order to verify the names of inmates on both sides, a Saudi technical delegation arrived in Sana'a, while another from the Prisoners Affairs Committee of Sana'a entered Riyadh, and the first stage of the swap deal clinched in Amman.
Sana'a always stresses the importance of humanitarian issues, and if there is a progress on humanitarian cases, it will lead to dialogue on political and military cases as well. There could be an extension of the terms and confidence building between the two parties. Sana'a welcomes any progress on humanitarian issues, encourages this visit, and asserts that its military warnings are serious, and moving toward peace is in the interest of Saudi Arabia.
The head of Yemen's National Committee for Prisoners' Affairs says the visits have nothing to do with any political talks. However, observers say this mutual visit is the first of its kind since the beginning of the war 7 years ago. Therefore, it is an indication of direct communication between Sana'a and Riyadh.
After nearly 8 years of war, siege, and the growing Yemeni military capabilities and the resilience of Yemenis, today the world realizes that Sana'a represents the Yemeni people. This is why we see international movements and international visits to Sana'a. The visit by the Saudi delegation is not the first of its kind, but there have been unannounced visits previously, and Sana'a welcomes peace endeavors.
Meanwhile, the head of Yemen's Supreme Political Council, Mahdi al-Mashat, held talks with Assistant Secretary General for Humanitarian Affairs of the United Nations, Joyce Msuya, in Sana'a. Al-Mashat urged the world body to reject all inhumane measures taken against the Yemeni people.
Following the failure to renew the UN brokered truce and the military parades of the Sana'a government, the international community is making new moves to find a more reliable agreement that satisfies both sides and ends the sufferings of millions of Yemenis. Abdulatif Loshali, Sana'a.
The olive harvest season has begun in the Gaza Strip, and farmers are picking olives on their land in order to provide for their families. Palestinian farmers and their families leave their everyday routines in the middle of October and dedicate some of their time to pick the fruits of nearly a year of hard work and special care. The olive harvest season runs until early November. The tiny coastal territory used to have a thriving olive industry, but it has suffered a major setback due to years of Israeli blockade and wars, as well as the systematic destruction of olive trees. The state of Gaza's olive farmers reflects the scope of human rights violations committed by the Israeli regime against thousands of Palestinian farmers. Israel's tight restrictions have been preventing farmers from acquiring badly needed equipment for irrigation and planting.
The situation is very difficult, especially for olive farmers. It takes many years to grow olive trees, and the Israeli blockade has made it extremely difficult for us to get fertilizers and badly needed farming equipment.
The annual olive harvest season is considered a key economic, social, and cultural event for Palestinians. Olive and agriculture in general have been hit hard by the Israeli blockade and war since 2007. Farmers here are struggling to keep this vital sector alive. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
There was no mention of peace talks to end the conflict in Ukraine as NATO defense ministers met in Brussels on Thursday. Spain, one of 30 NATO countries, has pledged to supply Kiev with advanced air defense systems.
This comes on top of what other allies have delivered over the last few days. I thank all allies for their significant contributions, and I urge them to continue to step up.
Ukraine's defense minister, Oleksiy Reznikov, attended the meeting in Brussels. While he's in Belgium, who's running things back in Kiev? It's a question we put to one expert during an online interview.
The Americans, because the Americans said we are offering intelligence information, we are coordinating the flow of weapons. They direct the battlefield. They have satellites under the disposal of their military.
NATO says it has doubled the number of its battle groups in eastern regions of the alliance. More than 30 warships are patrolling the Baltic Sea and North Sea. Critics say this steady build-up in recent years is designed to provoke Russia and keep NATO relevant while pumping trillions into the arms industry. NATO's Article 5 states that an attack on one member of the alliance is an attack on all of its members.
The United States is absolutely committed to its Article 5 commitments, and we are committed to defending every inch of NATO's territory if and when it comes to that.
NATO says Russia's nuclear forces are being closely monitored. The alliance confirms it's going ahead with nuclear war deterrence exercises next week, dubbed Steadfast Noon. The drills will involve nuclear-capable aircraft, but apparently will not include any live bombs. Asked if the timing is bad given heightened tensions, NATO boss Jens Stoltenberg said it would send out the wrong signal if the exercises were suddenly cancelled now. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
The British government started the week with a big question hanging over its head: how to fund its billions of pounds worth of tax cuts announced last month. While it continues to tout the benefits of its controversial growth plan, in the real world, the central bank has had to intervene a third time to try to stabilize the financial markets less than 2 weeks after Finance Minister Kwasi Kwarteng's announcement of his mini-budget sparked market turmoil and blistering political attacks.
Will the Chancellor now put aside his pride, do the right thing for our country, end this trickle-down nonsense and reverse the budget?
The response from the finance minister, defiant, despite his recent U-turn on tax cuts for the highest earners.
She should get her facts right. The IMF today have said that our growth is going up.
What the IMF has also said is that high levels of inflation will persist longer in Britain than in almost all other advanced economies.
The answer they're going to try and give to this is to say, actually get the economy to grow. But it's very difficult to get the economy to grow if the rest of the world economy is actually shrinking at the moment. So if we're by cutting taxes, they say we'll get things going. Well, actually, at the moment, what they're trying to do is actually slow the economy down to control inflation. That's what the Bank of England's doing. But the government is moving in the opposite direction and adding inflation to it. This doesn't make sense to us.
The Chancellor hasn't made it clear where the cuts will fall. The National Health Service has the largest budget, but cutting that isn't realistic. The Prime Minister is committed to increase defense spending, which leaves other areas, such as education and welfare, looking vulnerable again.
Well, that was done before, when we had to go through a period of austerity, and that was very unpopular indeed. If they're going to go through that again, they're going to be very unpopular, and it's not going to be accepted, I don't think. So it's going to be interesting to see which bit they're going to try and cut. Or are they really just going to bank on growth, in which case we can't see how they're going to do it.
More than 24 million Britons live on some sort of benefit. A further reduction is unthinkable.
The UK economy shrank unexpectedly in August. Inflation is at nearly 10%, interest rates are up, pension funds are on the brink, faith in the government shaken. And with the Bank of England's intervention in the markets ending this week, is another U-turn by the government in the offing. Sai Kaur is up, London.
A general strike and civil disobedience have been observed in occupied East Al-Quds and in many areas of the occupied West Bank to reject Israel's siege on Shafat refugee camp and Anata town northeast Al-Quds. Since Saturday, the Israeli military has kept over 130,000 Palestinians in the two areas under forced lockdown after sealing all military checkpoints. The siege has disrupted residents' vital interests. It has prevented them from accessing the rest of the city for work, school and medical care and other necessities in severe violation of their basic rights. Israeli military says the move comes as they are searching for a Palestinian gunman who killed an Israeli female soldier at a checkpoint at the entrance to Shafat on Saturday.
What goes on in these actions by the Palestinians are a normal response to the Israeli brutality and aggression against Shafat refugee camp and Anata town. The strike is meant to lift the siege imposed on Shafat and Anata, Al-Quds, Qalandia refugee camp, and other towns. We all responded to the call of civil disobedience and strike.
Also on Wednesday, the Israeli forces imposed a closure on the occupied West Bank city of Nablus, a day after an Israeli soldier was shot dead near an illegal settlement in the area. In addition to the major military checkpoints surrounding the city, dirt mounds have been placed on the Nablus area roads by military bulldozers to prevent Palestinians to use alternative exits. A manhunt is still underway to find the shooter. Israeli media revealed that the military was considering launching a large-scale operation in the northern West Bank in a bid to end the recent phenomena in struggle, armed struggle.
The resistance of the Palestinian people, and especially the armed resistance, as it happened in Jenin, and it moved to Nablus, and now from Nablus, we hope that it will be spreading all over the West Bank in order to resist this occupation. The phenomena that we are witnessing today in Nablus, this is the new way for the Palestinians to express their anger of this occupation, especially and particularly that all other political solutions is totally failed.
In recent months, the Israeli army have launched near daily raids to the West Bank, mainly in Jenin and Nablus, where Palestinian armed resistance is becoming more organized and new groups of fighters have been formed, the most popular now known as the Lion's Den.
Despite Tel Aviv's heavy-handed crackdown and collective punishment of Palestinians, they are keeping up their resistance against the regime using different tools. Every day, the Palestinians prove that the Israeli military's aggressive measures have failed to weaken their struggle. Mona Kandil, occupied Ramallah.
The EU's Temporary Protection Directive has been specifically activated to help Ukrainian refugees. It means they are guaranteed housing, healthcare, education and welfare payments in any of the bloc's 27 member states.
I would like today to announce that the Temporary Protection Directive will continue to be in place at least until March 2024.
The European Commission has also launched a scheme to make it easier for millions of Ukrainians in the EU to find jobs. At the same time, thousands of refugees fleeing other conflict zones continue to sleep on the streets throughout the bloc. Also, as the cost of living crisis in the EU intensifies, activists say the bloc's own citizens are not receiving adequate support.
Nowadays we see that people can be homeless and have a job. There is in-work homelessness, but there is also groups that are higher risk of losing their job from one day to the next.
As the war in Ukraine continues, the EU is pondering a ninth round of sanctions against Russia. Moscow's ally Belarus is also very likely to be targeted for cooperating with Russia.
All these steps, especially by the Belarusian regime, are against the will of the majority of the population and will be met with new and strong restrictive measures from the side of the European Union.
There have been renewed calls in the European Parliament for less focus on sanctions, less focus on arming Ukraine, and more focus on peace talks.
We need diplomats to finally take action. This is the view of 77% of all Germans. Political offers need to be made in order to encourage both sides to lay down their weapons.
According to many analysts, Western sanctions against Russia are clearly not working. Otherwise, a ninth package would not be on the agenda. In fact, economists say the current sanctions are hurting EU citizens far more than had been anticipated. Inflation and interest rates continue to rise with no clear end in sight. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
A new study covering a huge range of foreign policy issues found that a whopping 79% of Americans believe that the United States should continue to pursue negotiations with Iran. On almost no other key foreign policy question is there such broad support across generations and political affiliations.
Most Americans are heavily fatigued by endless wars and, U.S. Foreign policy adventurism overseas and, really want political leadership, regardless of which party we're talking about, that is concerned with, more pressing domestic needs.
The study's authors even declared that politicians who criticize diplomatic efforts with Iran are out of step with many of their voters. Joe Biden campaigned on a diplomatic return to the JCPOA pact on Iran's nuclear energy program. In a major backtracking, not only has he not continued to uphold the United States' end of the deal, but he has imposed round after round of new sanctions on Iran. From the Washington Beltway to Hollywood, Iranophobia, Islamophobia, and violent belligerence towards Tehran has been pushed by America's political, media, and academic elites. However, the poll seems to prove that these messages have been emphatically rejected by the average American.
The level of sway that the defense industry has over Washington, the defense lobby and the military-industrial complex, that's who the two major parties are beholden to. There's no real significant difference between the Republicans or the Democrats. And, you know, it's funny you mentioned the Iran deal. That's a perfect example.
The poll noted that for the fifth straight year, the percentage of Americans who think the U.S. should negotiate directly with adversaries has grown, now reaching 65%. Two-thirds of America supports the country's total withdrawal from Afghanistan. 40% of people declaring an opinion believe that the U.S. has not responded well to the unrest in Ukraine. The only foreign policy issue which gained as much support as diplomacy with Iran was that 80% of Americans demand more congressional oversight in the executive branch's ability to unilaterally declare wars. Ramin Mazahari, Chicago.
Afghan Muslims marked Islamic Unity Week and the birth anniversary of Prophet Muhammad, holding ceremonies in various cities. Here at Al Zahra Mosque in Kabul, Muslims gathered to celebrate Islamic Brotherhood and the legacy of Prophet Muhammad. Religious scholars and participants said they are facing conspiracies and brutalities cooking spied by arrogant powers and terrorist groups. They emphasized that Muslims can foil such plots through unity.
Uzbek, Hazara, Pashtun and Tajik, we are all brothers and members of the Islamic Ummah. It is our responsibility to unite around Prophet Muhammad. We denounce any division between Islamic sects and countries. The Muslim world is the common land of Muslims, and we don't believe in colonial era borders. Therefore, we should help liberate Al-Quds. Al-Aqsa Mosque is the beating heart of Islam. Prophet Muhammad said that the protecting Quds is the same as protecting Mecca and Medina.
Jamia Afghanistan.
Recently, the Afghan society faced devastating plots and challenges, but we could overcome them through unity among Muslims. The enemies of Islam and Aryan powers plotted different conspiracies, including terrorist attacks, to sow sedition and pave the way for their interventions. We Muslim brothers are aware and united. Such evil plots and acts will lead to nowhere.
Likewise, the Al-Mustafa University in Kabul hosted a conference to discuss the character and morality of the Prophet of Islam. The event addressed the important role of Prophet Muhammad as a messenger of peace and kindness. Attendees here said Prophet Muhammad is their best role model ever. The Islamic Unity Week comes as Afghanistan this year faced waves of terror attacks, especially against Shia mosques and schools. Afghans say such attacks will only strengthen bonds of brotherhood between Muslims in the country. The Afghan nation has successfully symbolized Islamic solidarity in their society. They say no to discord in the face of enemies' plots. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
In the limelight.
Former U.S. President Donald Trump on Friday, 14th of October, issued what he characterized as his official response to the January 6th Select Committee after the panel voted to subpoena him. But he didn't say if he'll testify to the January 6th panel. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this story. British newspaper The Guardian has more on the story. Donald Trump is considering testifying in front of the House January 6th committee, which this week concluded a dramatic hearing establishing what it says is his culpability for a deadly capital attack by voting to subpoena the former president. On Friday, 14th of October, sources close to Donald Trump confirmed to The Guardian that he may choose to appear before the congressional panel. Such an appearance would set up an unprecedented high-stakes political event. Donald Trump, meanwhile, issued an angry and rambling public letter to Benny Thompson, the Mississippi Democrat who chairs the January 6th panel.